I'm from the Michigan Department of Health and Human Services. My name is Joe Coyle. I'm sorry for the very literal title of our presentation. I know how much CSDE likes the puns. But presenting on a cluster of sexually transmitted hepatitis C virus among the MSM, men who have sex with men, population in Southeast Michigan. Because I do not have a pun, I did decide to throw in a potato-related cartoon, which has absolutely nothing to do with my presentation whatsoever. So I guess one of the nice things about having a little bit more time to speak is I can go through some more in-depth background and sort of literature review, which I hope to touch on in the first few points in this outline, and then get into this investigation, cluster investigation, that has been ongoing in Michigan. I don't think I have to talk too much about the transmission of hepatitis C to this group, but as you may be aware, sexual contact is considered a less common mode of hepatitis C transmission. So the data suggests, several studies suggest that serodiscordant couples, heterosexual couples, the risk of HCV transmission is quite low as 1 in 10 million sexual encounters. And it isn't necessarily recommended for serodiscordant couples to change their sexual practices, like practicing safe sex, for example. However, there is an increased risk of sexual transmission of hepatitis C in the HIV-infected population in men who have sex with men. But this has rarely been described, I think, in the United States, and that's one of the reasons we thought this would be interesting to present at the CSTE conference. There have been some individual case studies that have been found in some jurisdictions. New York City was one of the few, I think, that reported on an actual cluster, a very large cluster, of HCV in their MSM population between 2005 and 2010. So most of the reports of sexual transmission have come out of Europe, and if any of you work in STDs, that is probably not a surprise to you. They seem to be very much more progressive at studying STDs than we are in the United States. And I think one of the important things to note, and is in almost all instances where this has been reported in the literature, the population has been co-infected with HIV. And we heard a really great presentation from Lauren this morning where hepatitis C is often used as a marker of future risk for HIV in injection drug user populations because hep C spreads much more efficiently via IDU than HIV does. And the exact opposite is true with sexual transmission of hep C. So HIV is much more efficiently transmitted sexually, and therefore it often precedes hepatitis C infection in this population. So I wanted to go back to actually Europe and some of the work they've done in their HCV MSM population. This is a phylogenetic analysis that they did they published on in 2009, which is a long time ago now. And they found actually international clusters of transmission of hepatitis C. And so I want to talk a little bit more about risk of sexual transmission. So what are the behaviors that would precipitate this sort of transmission in the population? And so generally it's thought of unprotective, receptive anal intercourse, particularly with ejaculation, anal douching, group sex, sex toys, things like that, use of stimulants. There has been some methamphetamine use, cocaine use, other kind of party drugs in this population, which may not necessarily increase the risk of transmission, but may increase the types of sexual practices that might occur or the duration of those sexual practices. And then also ulcerative STIs like syphilis and lymphogranuloma vernarium that are can increase the risk of transmission of hep C and other STDs. So essentially anything that's disrupting the integrity of the mucosa can increase the risk of transmission. But there's more and more evidence now that suggests that hep C can be transmitted sexually in the absence of there being blood involved. And I thought this was really interesting. Some fairly new research that's come out of New York suggesting that in co-infected patients, 47% actually shedded hep C in their rectum, with only 2% having any evidence of rectal bleeding. Conversely, hepatitis C has been found in semen of the co-infected patients as well. So there's a possibility of transmission both ways. And so The STD guidelines from CDC do say that in the MSM population that's HCV infected, particularly if there's HIV co-infection, that those individuals should be practicing safe sex. And I don't want to hammer this too hard, but I think there is additional susceptibility to hepatitis C infection in individuals who may have HIV, and HIV may also enhance the ability to transmit hepatitis C sexually. And then, of course, as I think folks have talked about today as well, I won't go into this in a lot of detail, but HIV infection makes hepatitis C worse, and hepatitis C makes a HIV infection worse. So there's a really important infections to be detecting, linking to care, and linking to treatment. So now getting into our investigation. So this all started, I was actually doing a presentation on hep C in young adults at a meeting, and there was another an HIV nurse practitioner from Detroit who was doing a presentation on lymphogranuloma venereum infections. So it's a type of gonorrhea that we hadn't seen in Michigan since 2008, and we had a big cluster of these infections in 2015, 24 of them, in fact, all HIV infected, all in the MSM population in Southeast Michigan. And we got to talking afterwards, and she mentioned that there were at least six of her patients that also had co-infection with hepatitis C. And I almost dismissed it, frankly. I just thought, well, of course they have hep C infection. They're probably injecting drugs, doing cocaine, methamphetamine, who knows what. But let's see what's really going on here. We'll do a little bit more digging. And so that's how we found out about the first number of cases. And, of course, one of the first things that we tried to do was figure out how many cases might there actually be that we haven't really identified yet. Is it really just six, or is there going to be a lot more? And we knew from what the nurse practitioner told us in her clinic, they were really only doing baseline testing of their HIV-infected population for hepatitis C, and then they would only test them thereafter if they had elevated liver enzymes, which is actually not what the clinical practices would suggest that they do. So to identify additional cases, we, of course, set up a direct route of communication with this our HIV clinic in the city of Detroit. So whenever they had a patient come in that looked like it could be suspect transmission of hep C, they wanted to let us know immediately. We do often do matching of our hepatitis C cases in our surveillance system to HIV records and EHRs. And so we went back retrospectively and looked at those cases, and then prospectively would do matching thereafter to find newly reported cases. I'll talk about this a little bit more, but we did set up some public health coordination with our Detroit disease intervention specialists who were going out to do field investigations and contact tracing. So if they identified any individual who they thought we should know about, they also let us know. And then I have to get a shout out to Jenny Gubler, who was our main epi working on this project, who's unfortunately moved on due to some funding issues in Michigan, but she was really crucial in terms of scouring the various data sources that we have in Michigan, looking for additional co-infections, looking for risk factors, and coordinating between all the different groups that we had helping us out. So the first thing that I think we wanted to do in terms of figuring out how to progress this forward is coming up with a case definition. So we wanted to only count individuals who had a risk factor of MSM and no history of injection drug use whatsoever in Southeast Michigan, and we wanted those individuals to be HCV RNA positive or be a documented seroconversion. So someone that we know had a negative hepatitis C antibody test and then eventually seroconverted to being HCV antibody positive. We called the person a suspect case if we just weren't able to clearly identify what their risk factors were for acquisition, or if we didn't necessarily have a documented seroconversion or a positive hep C RNA. And a person that was a sexual contact of one of our cases was considered a contact case. So one of the first things we were doing in addition to identifying cases is figuring out how are we going to respond if we continue to identify individuals who look like they're infected. So the first thing that we did was send out a health alert to the clinicians in Southeast Michigan to let them know to be aware that this may be occurring in this population and to be on alert to test for hepatitis C when they identify individuals who kind of fit this bill. We did utilize the Detroit DIS to do contact tracing, education, and outreach. So this was a group that we really haven't worked with very closely before to do anything related to hepatitis, so they weren't really well trained on how to talk to patients about hepatitis, so that was really new for them. So we did a few in-services to educate them on that. As you're probably aware, in hepatitis, we're very there's not a ton of resources, and so we don't have the staff or the training to be able to go out and find individuals in the field and do that investigation. So we're really happy to have partnerships with the DIS, although they're severely overworked right now with the amount of work they're doing with data to care for HIV, primary and secondary syphilis investigations and follow-up. So they tried their best. We also wanted to make sure that when we identified contacts, that we could get them testing somehow, and testing for free, and hopefully could get any samples sent to our state health department for molecular analysis. And so we set up our Detroit STD clinic has walk-in appointments for anyone in the area, and so we enabled them to be able to do Hep C testing and send those isolates to our laboratory. So this was kind of our workflow. I'm not going to go over it in too much detail, but whenever we got a case in or looked like a suspect case, our epi would really go through a lot and dig into this case to figure out, have they been co-infected with syphilis, with HIV, what is going on, what are the risk factors reported for those communicable diseases, and what are their contacts that were reported when this individual was a syphilis case 2 years ago, things like that. And so when we were able to sort of adjudicate that we think this is definitely a case, we need to include it in our case count, that would be initiated to the Detroit DIS or the local health department DIS for additional follow-up of cases and contacts. And then eventually, hopefully getting those individuals sent to our state health department or the STD clinic for laboratory testing. All right, so let's talk about some epi info. I mean, still at this point, we're trying to put all the pieces together to figure out exactly what the scope is of what's going on here. I know this is going to be a busy slide, but I wanted to put it all out here for you to look at. So so far, I think this is still an ongoing issue, so these numbers are subject to change, but right now we've identified 29 cases that fit this bill. Interestingly, 5 of them are actually acute cases, 24 are chronic cases according to the CDC CSDE case definitions. And so I think that's something really important to note as we think about performing surveillance, not only looking at acute cases, but taking into consideration the chronic cases and think about both of those sort of individually or collectively. And we had 11 known seroconversions. Not all of those seroconversions occurred within a 12-month time frame, so they don't necessarily meet the acute case definition, but we can document that they definitely were HCV negative and now positive. Cases tended to be relatively young. They were all male, African American, except for one. Where we had Hep C genotype information, they were all genotype 1A, which is a very common genotype, but I still think a decent piece of epi information. 28 of our 29 cases reported no injection drug use. One of the cases said that he had recently started to inject drugs. We're not sure if he would have been doing that during his potential incubation period. There was no other drugs that were used by these individuals other than alcohol or marijuana. It seemed like during their interviews, they were very honest about the types of behaviors that they were engaging in. So there was no methamphetamine, no cocaine, nothing like that. They were all HIV positive, all reported to be MSM or bisexual. And you can see just a laundry list of other STDs, including syphilis, LGV, gonorrhea, chlamydia, and many other communicable diseases that I think are potentially interesting and worth noting, such as Hep A and other enteric illnesses, which is not unusual to necessarily see in the MSM population. This is our quote-unquote epi curve, and I put it in quotes because just because you're diagnosed with hepatitis C on a certain day doesn't mean that's necessarily when you were infected. So our investigation started at the end of 2015, is when we first got alerted to those 6 cases. And so we did some retrospective case finding and found a few, but most of them have been found sort of prospectively. And when you compare that to the, again, quote-unquote epi curve for HIV in these same individuals, you can see that HIV infection often was preceding the hepatitis C, which is probably an artifact of how we were doing our case counting and our case definition. But nevertheless, the HIV infections were not all necessarily new. So out of the, I was only able to collect this information from 28 of our 29 at before uploading this presentation, but 22 out of the 28 HIV did precede the diagnosis date of the hepatitis C. There was 6 out of 28 where HIV and hep C were diagnosed in the same time frame. In terms of HIV care, 25 out of the 28 cases were engaged in care for their HIV, and 19 out of the 28 were virally suppressed. We do know that we weren't able to really follow their hepatitis C treatment very well, at least very a way that I could quantify. But we do know that there was very good referral to care to a related clinic in Detroit for a lot of these patients. So we're happy with how patients are being linked to care for hep C, but I'm not sure that they're all necessarily being treated or cured. So again, we still have a high number of cases, but it begs the question, are these cases really related to each other or not? And at this point, we still really don't know. Traditionally, what we would do in these instances is look at contact tracing that the DIS was able to do to figure out how many of these individuals are sexual contacts of each other. And the DIS did okay. Again, it's really the best that they could do, and we can definitely see potentially some clusters here. But there were cases that were really all over the board, and we weren't able really to piece together where they might fall in this larger sort of transmission network. And you can see here some of these boxes. There were a lot of individuals that we could not get to present to the Detroit STD clinic to get hepatitis C testing, which was unfortunate. And then there was a lot of anonymous sex in this population, which, again, is probably no surprise. And even if these individuals wanted to name their sexual contacts, there was really no ability for them to do that. So we were really excited that we're a pilot site through APHL to do hepatitis C next-gen sequencing called HCV Ghost. And essentially what it is it takes this hypervariable region of the hepatitis C genome right here, and each individual that's infected with hep C will have multiple copies of this hypervariable region. And so what happens is we sequence this, we get the sequences, and probably you're looking at a few dozen different sequences per person, and you compare that to a database of all your other individuals. And I think at this moment we might be the only laboratory outside of the CDC that's doing this testing in-house. We really wanted to get it done, to get up and running with this for detection of IDU clusters, but it just so happened that this was going on at the exact same time, and it's really good for outbreak detection and response. And so generally what would happen is you'd spit out this, it's all behind the CDC SAMS portal. It would spit out a phylogenetic analysis and then kind of a transmission network. So here's the results that we received. And I'll note here that all of these individuals on the right are actually not part of the MSM investigation. Our laboratory does a lot of testing for hep C, so these were individuals that were reported to us for other reasons that we had specimens on them. And then all of our MSM cases clustered really nicely into this phylogenetic analysis. And so then we can come up with this was the CDC's output, where these dark blue circles are not part of the outbreak. The light blue circles are part of the outbreak. So there was really, really good evidence that of the people that we were able to get hep C RNA on, that they were all very, very closely genetically related to each other, suggesting that there was a common source of their infection. So it really helped us understand this situation a lot better, that we know now that this isn't necessarily concurrent small outbreaks going on at the same time. It may be all interconnected, or at least larger connected than we may have originally thought. So again, back to the transmission network that the DIS were able to put together. These were the individuals that were that we had specimens on for HCV Ghost. And so then we can start putting that molecular information together with the information that the DIS were able to obtain and put together something that looks more like this, where there are still a lot of individuals where we don't know how directly they are related to this cluster, but it helps us link a lot more of these patients together. of course, we would love to get more Hep C RNA on all of these individuals to see are these all really interconnected. But I think this is really important that we're doing this molecular analysis on the Hep C specimens, but these individuals are not sexual contacts just for their hepatitis C. They're sexual contacts for syphilis, for gonorrhea, for HIV, for hepatitis A maybe, for Giardia. Like, this information I think is really valuable, but it's valuable outside of the scope of just a single condition. And I think we really need to think about that and sharing that information more broadly. And so that was one of the things that we wanted to make sure we did, is share this information with the DIS, because they weren't able to necessarily put all of these patients together. And now with this molecular analysis, we can actually do that. So a couple observations and conclusions. There are some things that we're not going to be able to quantify, but I think are really interesting to think about. In the era of highly active antiretroviral therapy for HIV, I think in serosorting and PrEP, I believe that there's at least enough data to suggest that people who are HIV infected or don't have a perceived risk anymore of HIV transmission because they're already infected, they know their partner is HIV infected, or they know both of their partners are on PrEP or something like that, they may have riskier sexual behaviors because there's no fear of HIV anymore because they're already on treatment, they're already infected. So that may be occurring in this population, don't know for sure. It really would begs for a qualitative sort of analysis, I think, of this. We definitely know that there was anonymous sex using geo-social networking apps, which is, I think, very common in this population. We definitely need to do a lot better education of clinicians. All HIV-infected patients should be tested for hepatitis C when they're engaged in care for their HIV, and I think every 6 months or a year afterwards. And that just wasn't occurring in this population. I think a lot of these infections might have been picked up earlier. Most of the testing, at least in the early stages, was done only when liver enzymes were elevated. And I think there is at least some evidence in the literature to suggest that reinfection in this population is really, really high for hepatitis C. And so I don't think we have any legitimate, really robust studies of this in the United States, and I'm interested in kind of exploring that a little bit more. And then I think one of the things that's potentially interesting is that we had some individuals who were positive for Hep C RNA but didn't actually produce Hep C antibody for over a year and a half. So if you're only doing testing for just Hep C antibody, you might be missing some of these cases. And I just threw it out there as a question. Should we be recommending HCV RNA testing, especially as the price of RNA testing kind of decreases? Maybe that's something that's worth looking at. So timely molecular data can help piece together disjointed transmission networks. I think you could see that the DIS did really good work as best as they could, but sometimes they just can't put all the pieces together, and sometimes even the clients themselves couldn't identify their sexual contacts. So having that molecular analysis, I think, is huge. I definitely need to plug the roundtable that's going on tomorrow about core surveillance, because I think a lot of the stuff that's going on here kind of falls into that realm. Having the ability to do the surveillance and having the laboratory capacity, I think, is huge for not only the detection, but then thinking about the response and how to integrate with the DIS and performing outreach, contact tracing, education, things of that nature. And again, I think kind of a soapbox thing for me, but I think programs and clinicians really need to be encouraged to think about the interconnectedness of these patients and all of their health needs, communicable disease and otherwise, and sharing that information more broadly. And I think, you know, would this information help out a hepatitis A investigation or a Giardia investigation, for example? So in summary, sexual transmission of Hep C in the MSM population, I think, is maybe a new and emerging public health issue. It's certainly new to, I think, identify it in sort of this way. And I think we're reporting here on one of the first clusters of this in the United States that at least I'm aware of. And I think these are really, really serious infections. We do have one of the individuals that died, and it's really important to be linking these individuals to care for not just their HIV, but their hepatitis C as well. And many, many thanks to many, many people who helped us out with this. Thank you.
First of all, I want to thank you so much. It was really great, innovative work. It's really exciting to see these kinds of results, so thank you very much. One question I had is, you said that there were a number of different ways that the initial cases could get fed to the DIS, and I was wondering, had those different mechanisms worked? So what was most successful at actually getting those first cases?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think we really were figuring out a lot of it as we went, and we were trying to find like the path of least resistance to getting action by the DIS, and I think they had a lot on their plate, and it was challenging at first, especially because they were really uncomfortable going out and engaging people about hep C infections without a lot of information. So we had to, or just a lot of education about hepatitis C, and a framework for where they would even refer them to go for testing, where they would refer them to go for treatment. And so we did have to do a lot of background work to get that sort of up and running. And one of our epis, Jenny, was really fantastic in being able, she sometimes would just go to Detroit and share information with them, just to kind of have that one-on-one, face-to-face with the DIS, like, here's kind of what our expectations are, what are the barriers, and sort of fostering that relationship with them, I think was really, really beneficial and helped us down the road.
It's really, really interesting. I'm Ann Winters from New York City, and we're really interested in this same issue and how to identify these individuals. And I had a few questions. One is the sequence of like phylogenetic testing. Were you doing HIV testing, molecular testing as well, or were you just and the specimen collection? Could you just talk to me about how you got the specimens from the patients? Was this from their HIV testing holdover, or did you have to go back and get those specimens?
So it was a little bit of both for the Hep C. So patients would come into the STD clinic, and they would be triaged there. They would ask what the patient's risk factors are. If they were MSM, they would just test them for Hep C and syphilis and everything. So then we were getting those specimens sent directly to us. Whether they were really part of the investigation, like whether we knew about them being cases or contacts or not. So that's how we got the Hep C isolates on the majority of cases. Some of the patients were tested at clinics or hospitals elsewhere. And when we were notified of those, we would ask the laboratory, do you have any blood left? Could you please send it to us for additional typing? But your first question, I think, is a really interesting one in terms of the phylogenetic analysis. So this was just Hep C. That was when we did the laboratory transmission network. But I think it speaks to the greater point that we really need to have just better data sharing, because I know HIV is doing a ton of molecular networking work, and we don't really see those results in hepatitis C. So I'm interested to see how exactly, what sort of overlap there would be. Some of our HIV infected cases were older, but some of them were new incident HIV infections, and I wonder what the interconnectedness is of those.
Can I ask one more quick question? You may have mentioned this in the beginning, but your access to all of these data registries, so HIV, STD, hepatitis C, did you have to kind of go through those requests to get access to do the matches, or do you have broader access?
We have really, really good data sharing in our bureau and in our division, and I think that's really helped us a lot in terms of doing the data matching. All of the communicable diseases are in one surveillance system other than the HIV, so we're able to look, everything gets matched on a patient level, so we're able to look at a patient record and identify what other case report forms might have been filled out on them in the past and what interview records and field records. And so it's really seamless and easy for us to look at all that information.
That's great. Thanks.
Hi, Joe. Thanks. Great presentation. I'm Lauren from Wisconsin. We have an epi in our HIV program that's trying to do something similar with the HIV phylogenetic data to match with what the DIS has found in their contact tracing and asking about the partners. I thought that piece was very powerful when you could show that they were all connected through the phylogenetic data, but the data that you showed from DIS wasn't as easy to connect as far as what I saw in the squares. Is it a totally different measurement, or would you expect that maybe even though somebody didn't name a contact, they don't necessarily need to name a contact to be connected to that person in that phylogenetic connection? Or did CDC kind of let you know what a connection means, and did you expect to have a connection of people who didn't necessarily name them each other?
Yeah, I think we knew that there were some cases that said and the DAS are very familiar with it. Like, we're not, this person, we're going to try and get their contacts, but they're not going to share any of their sexual contacts with us. We just know that they're not going to. And in those sorts of instances, having the molecular analysis to link them into the cluster without having to actually solicit their contacts, I think is really, really valuable. And so I think that's what we've been able to show, is that when the DIS information is incomplete, which it frequently is, unfortunately, especially with the anonymous sex that goes on in this population, that molecular analysis is hugely beneficial.
All right, thank you, Joe.